This is Lina Mirmont back. I am with my Lina Life show. And frankly, I have a very little patience left before introducing extraordinarily interesting guest, which we have. His name is Dr. Rob Dunn. And his world of knowledge, vision, and experiments has to do with the species and the world around us, which we are not too aware of, the world which we need to appreciate, respect, and love much more than we do. So we will take this opportunity to have our conversation with Dr. Rob Dunn, who is a biologist and a writer, and he is a part of the Department of Biology at North Carolina State University, who has very generously developed his research, friendship with the students, has his colleagues ignited with his own enthusiasm about the outside world. Dr. Rob Dunn allowed me to call him Rob, which makes me feel even more at home with something which I'm inviting him to participate. Rob, welcome to our program.
Oh, it's a great pleasure, Lina. I'm really looking forward to this conversation.
And since I'm so impatient, I will jump into it right away. We like to know, where do we stand with our knowledge and awareness with the species around ourselves?
So that's a really interesting way to put that question. I sort of speak from two perspectives in answering a question like that. One is that of an ecologist, and one is that of somebody who writes about and studies people. And those perspectives are a little bit different. And so from the perspective of an ecologist, we've thought of most of the species we look at out in the world as being dependent on many, many other species. But from the perspective of humans, that sentiment is relatively new. We love the idea that each one of us is sort of a lone wolf in the universe with free will and control of our fate. And the thing that we now know to be most clear is that's totally wrong. That each one of us is not only dependent on many other species, but really in a very fundamental way is composed of many other species. And so, Lina, when you woke up this morning thinking of yourself as yourself, the truth is that you literally have thousands of species on your body that affect your health and well-being, that maybe even affect your personality, that affect how you digest food. And so that's sort of our starting point. That's what we've learned that much to be true. And now what we're trying to figure out is how all of this works. You know, we think we have a sense of how our fingers work or how our bones work, but how does our relationship with all of these species work? And as a scientist who started to work in some of these fields, on the one hand, it's incredibly exciting because there are new discoveries literally every day. But on the other hand, when I have the chance to step back, and this is what the writing does, the truth is it feels much more like we're all lurching into a darkness together. There's this incredible ignorance we still have about our lives. And so that's what we're starting to learn, both that we're interdependent and that we're way more ignorant than we ever imagined.
And that's actually my first question was helped by you, because in one of the points, I was reading that indeed you said that we know so little. And in fact, there was some kind of an interesting misconception that we know, we thought that we know now more, when indeed we learned more 100 or 200 years ago. And somehow it is a disconnection in my mind. How come we knew something more so long time ago and we know so little now?
Yeah, so I think that we somehow as humans have this repeated tendency to believe that we know almost everything. And on the one hand, and so there's just that general sense. We wake up in the morning and we look at, you know, our bodies and we think somebody understands them. But then I think what you're referring to in the context of the history is that if we think about what was going on in the world, let's say 12,000 years ago, there was a point in which peoples all around the world knew something about the species around them. And so if you look at, for example, modern groups of hunter-gatherers, they typically know most of the basic plant species around them, and they know many of the animal species. And if at that moment in history we had actually pooled all of the knowledge of all the hunter-gatherers and agriculturalists all around the world, there are many groups of organisms for which we would, as a function of that collective knowledge, know more at that moment in history than we know today. And to take a simple example, bees and wasps. Traditional peoples often know a lot about bees and wasps, both because they can be useful and because they sting. And so if you would have taken the knowledge of which bee and wasp species or folk species live in different places around the world 12,000 years ago, we would have actually known more than we do today, because the truth is, in most parts of the world, nobody can tell you which bee and wasp species live there. It's a really interesting reality. You can live in New York or Raleigh, and you know, you sit in your office and look out the window, and everything looks like, well, somebody must understand that. But the truth is, most of what you see living is at best poorly understood, and I would say in most cases not even given a name.
And that's something which actually made me think in a certain terms which I never ever would think before I would come close to your books and some of your discoveries. And I like to talk a little bit more specifically about some microscopical species, so you can give us a little bit specificity about their function and relationship with the human. But before that, I really wanted to ask you to elaborate in a really very profound connection with medical problems. You are making connection with such unfortunately, well-established diseases like diabetes, autism, some anxiety disorders, even allergies. It leads even to the dental issues. So those connections are really took me by very powerful surprise. Can you comment on that, please, on that connection?
Yeah, sure. So I think for most of medical history, we've tended to focus on killing bad species, and that's benefited us all. Many of the people listening wouldn't be alive today if it weren't for antibiotics, if it weren't for, even in some cases, pest control. So in the southern U.S., many of us are alive because of the use of DDT originally to control malaria vectors, for example. But at the same time, one of the things we've come to realize is that as our daily lives become more and more separate from the kind of nature we used to be exposed to, that we can also get sick when we miss species, when species that used to be part of our daily lives go absent. Your question asked about many different diseases, but there's a whole suite of diseases related to the overreactivity of our immune systems. And many of those diseases seem to be associated with the shift from living traditional agricultural or forest-dwelling kinds of lives to living lives in which we spend very little time outside, and in which most of the species we interact with in our homes. And so one of the really interesting studies in this regard was done by a group led by Ilkka Hanski in Finland. And what Hansky wanted to know was, if you take a given city in which people live in different ways in the same city, you know, it could be New York, you know, it could be Boston, and in his case it happened to be a medium-sized Finnish city, and you ask the question, well, how does the health and well-being of people in that city vary as a consequence of which species they interact with? What Hansky and his colleagues found was that there was a really strong effect of the number of kinds of native plant species outside of people's houses on their risk of allergy. And allergy tends to be associated with a whole suite of other things. If you're more at risk of allergy, you're also more at risk of Crohn's and a bunch of other autoimmune disorders, and even to some extent diabetes. And so what he found was that in adolescents, those adolescents with more native plants outside their house had a much reduced risk of allergy. In fact, they essentially showed little evidence of allergies. And so the question then is, what's going on? And what people have posited is that one of the key elements of a successfully functioning immune system is that you're exposed to a diversity of kinds of microbes, of natural microbes, particularly those associated with soil or those living on plants. And in fact, Hansky and colleagues found that those adolescents who were living in houses with more kinds of native plants in their backyards had different species of bacteria on their skin. And so what they've argued, and I think it's quite plausible and it makes sense in the context of many other studies in the last few years, is that having more kinds of native plants in your backyard changes which microbes come into your house, but also which microbes you're influenced by when you go outside your house, which change which microbes are on your skin, which change your immune system's function. And so I think it's... this is really part of a very global phenomena because more and more we shift to these habitats. I mean, especially apartment living, we're not exposed to any sort of natural environments or soil. And so more and more we're like the allergic kids in those studies. And so there's a whole suite of maladies associated with that phenomena. And these are precisely the problems that tend to be on the rise. I mean, in the U.S., Crohn's disease is on the rise. Allergies are on the rise. Allergies to all kinds of crazy things. Rheumatoid arthritis is on the rise. And so these are all immune system modulated problems where the immune system is too reactive. And so I would argue, that, and lots of people are now arguing, that part of what's happening there is that our immune system is not being exposed to those cues it's used to be being exposed to. And so I think one of the big questions is, if that's true, what do you then do? And I don't mean to hijack where you were going, Lena, but that's one of the key things there. And so I think one of the possibilities, and this is one that the medical community has not thought a lot about historically, is that we actually start to kind of garden our bodies. You know, that we do need to be able to kill really bad pathogens that show up, but what if we can also favor beneficial species? And I should say for context for the audience that nobody listening has a single part of the outside of their body that does not have bacteria on it, not a single inch anywhere. And that's true even after you use soap and water. So if you wash your hands with soap and water, your hands are still covered in bacteria. It's like a kind of hairy suit that you wear. And so that's also true for your house. And so the inside of your house, every surface we've ever sampled in houses, we've recovered bacteria from. That's even true from antimicrobial wipes, which have bacteria on them. And so the choice is not these... do we have these microbes in our lives? The choice that collectively I think we face is which ones do we have, and can we garden some good ones? And I don't mean to talk too long there, Lena, but I think that's starting to get at some of the stuff you're asking about.
Absolutely. There is. I'm not even conscious of time. I'm only conscious of amount of questions which I like to ask you, and absolutely every moment of your clarification actually creates another question. So we're all thinking while you're talking, so no one is aware of time, but the content is phenomenal. I wanted to ask you a reverse question. Because the human becomes so unhealthy, sterile, filled with an antibiotics, filled with this food which is missing artificially so many components, for example, this low-fat food, the consumption of life became so dangerously unhealthy. Are we killing a good bacteria? Are we destroying this natural flora or natural world around ourselves?
Yeah, I mean, I think a really interesting perspective in this is that there are now a suite of studies, and we have one coming out soon, linking the effects of having a dog to the bacteria that are on your body and in your house, and then your immune health. And so we don't have all the pieces, but it looks like mothers who have a dog in their house when they're pregnant have their children at less risk of developing allergies. Recently, a friend of mine, Rob Knight, has shown that people living together with a spouse and a dog actually end up sharing more bacteria from their dog. I don't know what that means those people were doing with their dogs, but and then finally, we're showing that if you have a dog in your house, it fundamentally alters the microbes in your house. And so if you take a Q-tip and you swab your TV screen and give it to us, we can tell you based on the microbes whether or not you have a dog. I say all of this because in part what the dogs are doing is that they're our last little connection to nature in many cases. And so it looks like what the dogs are essentially doing is bringing in microbes from the outside, from the dirt, from the park, from the wherever, into our homes, and providing this teeny little conduit back to the natural world. And so in a way, I think there are two interesting measures of our disconnection from all these species. One's the dog effect, which is to say that we're so disconnected from nature that a dirty dog can, to some extent, make us more healthy. But the other is that I think it's useful for people to think about how dire the consequences of this change are. So Clostridium difficile is a very, very common pathogen in hospitals, and people get it other places too, and it's actually found in the body pretty frequently just in general. But what happens is that for people who take antibiotics frequently, and sometimes this happens in the hospital when you're trying to deal with a bad infection or some other context, Clostridium difficile can grow through the intestines and take over. And when that happens, the best treatment is still to use antibiotics again. And the good news is that Clostridium difficile can't compete very well with the native bacteria in your gut. But the bad news is if you use all those antibiotics and your native bacteria are kind of gone, then it can just take over and it grows very, very quickly. Yeah. And so then every time you use antibiotics again, it grows back really, really quickly again.
And that's, and, if and I may, can, in the
oh,
chat.
Oh, please do.
Yes, that's where a role of probiotics kicks in if I'm in the same thought with you. So it will counter antibiotic destruction, introducing a good bacteria to the intestinal tract.
Yeah, so probiotic. There's sort of three kinds of probiotics in that sense. One is the you know sort of yogurts and other probiotics, and the other I would say is eating foods that make your bacteria do work. You know, so fruits and nuts that you know what the bacteria in your gut are doing. They need food to survive, and they need food that they like. And they like fruits and nuts and things that are a little bit hard for us to digest. Yeah. And so, in a way, that's a prebiotic. It's food for them. But the other thing that happens is that if you get one of these infections and it doesn't clear up, one of the best treatments is a fecal transplant. And so you actually get somebody else's feces that's been centrifuged, and then it goes up through your nose and down into your digestive tract. And I mean, if you want an object lesson in why you should be good to your bacteria, it's because if you don't, you might have to get somebody else's feces up your nose, which seems like incentive enough to avoid. But the other really interesting... Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Lena, please.
No, I just was going to ask you, Rob, is there any other ways of delivering this? I love the idea. It's just delivery a little bit difficult.
Yeah. Well, you're out in most cases when it's happening. I think it's less gross than it sounds. But you can they also do it via enema. And 2 years ago, I think people would have said it was crazy. And now there have been a number of clinical trials that have been very, very successful. And people are now, the less gross version is if you have an ear infection, there's actually been neat work showing that you can take microbes from your other ear, use those to inoculate the ear with the ear infection, and that it's a reasonably good treatment for ear infection. And so that's way less gross, but the same thing. And then the last piece like this is that a friend of mine, Bill Parker, has argued that the appendix is actually a storage organ for good bacteria, so that if you get an infection like this, that your gut can then be recolonized by bacteria from the appendix. And it looks like he's right. Recently, there was a study showing that people with no appendix are actually they have more trouble recovering from C. diff, like three times more difficulty. And so you have these different kinds of probiotics. The best one is to eat food that your bacteria like and don't kill them with antibiotics unless you really need them. The second best is unless you really need it out, you can that appendix does you some service, although if it's inflamed, it can be very dangerous, so please do seek treatment. And then the third is if stuff gets really bad, remember that you've got this fecal transplant on the horizon, which may get less gross as time goes on. But, that's all. I mean, Lena, that's very new science, and it's one of these amazing things where a few years ago people would have said all of this was crazy, that's the margins of science. And now you talk to very, very, very serious, sedate microbiologists who now think of this as ordinary.
I think we can be so, so grateful to the diffusion between microbiology, chemistry, and medicine, that they are not so separated and so segregated as a science as it was just a number of years ago. And I only confirmed my sharp anticipation of this program because you certainly informing all of us about the most natural self-human communication, because even though it sounds strange and it's extremely new and partly wild, but it's really very profoundly natural. It's like a human sharing with another human what it needs. It's somewhat putting chemical medication, which can be toxic and have all these side effects on the side, and exploiting all these natural substances, which we didn't have any idea could be so beneficial. So it's not sound that, in one sense, not surprising after you gave such a wonderful detailed explanation. Even though, of course, the procedure definitely doesn't miss any novelties. Like to make a little more concrete leap to your book. The Wildlife of Our Bodies seems to be the last sensation you created. However, I would say that every living thing is a fantastic preparation and a fantastic foundation for understanding of what we're talking about. I just wanted to congratulate you on the one artistic thing. The wildlife of our bodies is beautifully arranged. The hardcover very cleverly introduces the subject. It's I just will briefly do my best to describe it, overcoming a radio limitations. It's a human body which cuts on pieces with the introduction of the species world. So right there, you can have a very sharp and nearly comprehensive idea what the book is all about. And before I will move to my question, I'd like to ask you, Rob, if you will tell us where we can buy your book and whether we can buy both of the books and whether we can get it through your website or any other sources.
Yeah, so if you go to my website, robrdunn.com, you can see both the books and my other writing. And the books, I think, are quite reasonably priced, but lots of the other writing is absolutely free. And then we do a lot of work on, for, about, and with the public in terms of not just writing about science, but doing science. And that work can be found at yourwildlife.org. And so one of the exciting things about writing these books is that I've really had the realization that we know so little about all these species around us that we really can engage the public in studying these species with us. And I'll give you a really simple example in that regard is that we have a few thousands of people that we have on an email list, and you can sign up for that at yourwildlife.org. But we sent out an email to people at one point asking which species they lived with in their houses. And we gave them a list of mostly animals to choose from, and one of those is a camel cricket. Lena, do you have camel crickets in your house? Do you know what they
I don't
look
even
like?
Know.
So they,
I'll be honest
they, oh, sorry. They're a cricket with long, long, long antennae, and they're often found in basements and cellars.
Oh,
and kind of
you know, sorry interrupting you. Not only we have it, I love them because we don't have a dog, and I'm dreaming to get a dog. So we have a little pets around the house. I'm not sure that after this confession I will have any friends over, but I personally love them. They're elegant, they survive in the winter, and my son imitates their jumps. I think they're absolutely remarkable, and if you will tell me that they have some kind of a special vitamins for my life, I will love them even more.
Oh, I love that, Lena. That's the best response I've ever gotten about the camel crickets. So we asked people, do you have these? Well, that's great. Turns out we know almost nothing about them. So you and your son can take notes, and almost anything you learn about them will be new. So one measure of how little we knew about them is we asked people, do you have these? And so 1,000 people responded, and if anybody wants to respond on our website, they can as well. We'd love to hear from everybody. But then we looked at a map, and the people that had responded that they had them were all sort of on the east coast of North America. And these crickets are supposed to be all over North America. They're kind of cave crickets. And so we thought, well, maybe people are looking at a mouse and thinking it's a cricket, or they're not looking at the right thing. So we said, send us your pictures. And so people sent their pictures, and we realized that the cricket that everybody had in their basement was a Japanese species that scientists had not realized had moved basement to basement to basement across North America. And it's a species we know almost nothing about. We don't really know what it eats. You know, some people say, oh, it eats my cat food, my cat's food, I guess not my cat food. But so the great thing for us is that with studies like this, the public can help us to study these these parts of our daily lives that are really hard for us to see, because we could never go sample 1,000 basements. But we can enlist people to help us sample 1,000 basements. And so we kind of feel like Lewis and Clark, except we're Lewis and Clark with thousands of other people along for the ride. And instead of going west across North America, we're going into bedrooms and bathrooms and every so often colons. And so, you know, this is one of these really fun things that's emerged from the books. Is it this real awakening to the reality that people want to know about the species on them. They want to know about the species around them. And we can all study these things together. And so that's what we do.
This is fantastic that you have this communication, like an open dialogue with the public that can share experience with the pictures. That's a fantastic way to have your data and probably extend your research. So we not only having migration of people, we have a migration of our species.
No, yeah, it's certainly true. I mean, it's really been great, and I think one of the struggles for among scientists is to figure out how to do work that's relevant, how to do work that matters to people, and the neat thing is that by working with many, many people, we hear all the time which things people are excited about, and we also hear which things people are bored with too, and we try to listen to that. So it makes it really fun. And I started off working in rainforests, and so I'd fly away to Bolivia or Peru and work on these species nobody knew anything about. And it took me a long time to realize that I could go in my backyard or even in my house. We have a project called the Wildlife of Our Homes, and a related project called the Arthropods of Our Homes. And in the arthropod study, so arthropods are insects, but also spiders and centipedes and all these things that run around our houses. It turned out that nobody had ever surveyed how many species of these things are living in our houses. And aside from the ones we really hate, so people have studied roaches and bedbugs, but aside from those things, we don't really know what most of these species are. And so along with the Museum of Natural Sciences here in Raleigh, we've been starting to just go in and try to exhaustively survey people's houses. And people are great. They open their door. They help us look. And we've been finding more than 100 species of animals in most people's houses. And most of those we don't know anything about. And so there's an amazing little yellow wasp that we find in almost every house. And that wasp lays its eggs inside the bodies of some other animal. But we don't know which other animal, because we don't know anything about this wasp. It's probably new to science, and yet it's been in almost every house we've looked in. I really thank the public both for welcoming us into homes, but also for reminding me of a lot of the joy of what we get to do as scientists.
I'm going to jump into your a few articles. I just need to be proper to your formal accomplishments. You are extremely well publicized in major international magazines like Natural History, BBC Wildlife Magazine, Scientific American, of course, Smithsonian Magazine, and of course, National Geographic. And I did browse through a few of your articles, and you had quite a experiences. In fact, your wife was not terribly happy with your taking chances with wild monkey. So you're not only dealing with the miniature elegant species, you do go to a true wild world. And the article which I came across in BBC Wildlife Magazine does describe your experience with your friend, I believe, which has to do with a bit of a dangerous dangerous dialogue with nature, with the wild monkeys. Maybe you can tell us about this.
Well, that's right. Well, so even as a biologist, I'm not always adept at communing with nature in the right ways. And so this was my buddy Rich Dreyer, who's been a friend for a long time, and I were in the forest in Ecuador, and we'd gone off trail when we weren't supposed to, and we were following a noise, which I think in retrospect was a king vulture, which is this enormous, beautiful vulture with this brilliantly colored head, and I mean, really one of the neatest birds in the world. And so we saw one and heard one and kind of followed where it had gone in the forest, and we're trying to figure out what was going on. And we came upon a troop of woolly monkeys above us. And I'm going to blame Rich, although I'm sure when Rich tells this story, he blames me for the idea of grabbing a branch and shaking it at the monkeys that were above us in the forest. And I guess in retrospect, our idea was to try to. I think we were enthusiastic about the idea that we could communicate something to the monkeys. I don't know if we would have phrased it in that way at that moment, but I think there is something primitive and exciting about the idea that you could interact with another mammal and another primate all the more and say something. And so we started shaking these branches, and the woolly monkeys started shaking the branches too and making, you know, noises back down at us, and they kind of gathered around us in the trees. And so we were really excited. And so we started shaking the branches some more, and it seemed at the moment like a not very dangerous situation. But what we had not taken into account, and actually what I failed to take into account many times after that, was gravity, which is what the monkeys had on their side. We were the fallen primate, as it were. And so as they shook the branches, all sorts of fruits and nuts and branches started to fall down at us. We didn't get struck by anything.
You probably had vitamins for the rest of your life.
Yeah, I mean, I think we almost accidentally got a monkey fecal transplant.
That is truly so picturesque, I can imagine. So maybe we should not avoid birds' feces. Some would say that if you got some on your clothes, that's a good luck. Well, maybe we should try to take it internally, who knows. But thank you for sharing this story. The other one is, before I will jump to the question of some relationship between species and medical benefits, I was quite fascinated by another article. The name of it is The Dodo's Sister. And that has to do with something which I, frankly, was taken by another surprise. You say that virtually there is no such a thing as an empty place. You're saying that, I believe I have even a text of it, yes, that ocean islands, chains, which is built by volcanic activities, are initially lifeless. However, then you continue on saying that with a time, there is a again formation of certain population of either a bird will come, someone will come, and someone will establish a species world. So there is no such a thing as a lifeless space on Earth.
No, I mean, I think that's true, and I think it's, I don't know if I said it well there, but I think it's a very fundamental sentiment that, you know, if you look up at the clouds are full of bacteria. The bacteria rains down in the rain. The bacteria help to actually form snowflakes. And so So many snowflakes at their center have bacteria in them. No one has yet dug a hole into the earth deep enough to not find life. And so we live on a planet that's cursed, blessed with life in every bit and piece. And, you know, we imagine, I think we have this amazing ability to imagine lifeless things. We imagine that when we go into the grocery store and we wipe some magical cloth on the grocery cart, that suddenly everything around us is devoid of life. But everything is covered in life. And I think that has many beautiful aspects. And so those same oceanic islands through time were colonized by plants and animals, and then those animals diversified. And so at one point in history, each Pacific island had its own kind of flightless rail species, these little birds that run around. But I think it should be also humbling in the sense that we often talk about the end of life, or, you know, that we're treating nature so badly that there'll be lifeless places. And the truth is, what's at risk when we treat nature badly is not life, because almost every assault that we can wage on Earth actually benefits some species. You know, the nuclear reactive sites are covered with you know, species that do well in those contexts. Heavily polluted sites and also species that do well there. But what we had the good fortune to move into in many parts of the world are places that are relatively hospitable to our kind of life. And that's the thing we compromise. We don't compromise life overall. We compromise a kind of life that we find beautiful and in its best circumstances, fruitful and easy. And so I think that's an interesting lesson of these island situations. You know, that you can have a volcano and create for a moment a lifeless surface, but soon it's not lifeless. We can colonize all of Eastern North America with cement and imagine that it's lifeless. And it's lifeless just until the cement dries. But the question there is, what kind of life would we like to have around us? And I, for one, would like the beautiful versions of the island filled with many kinds of birds. I'd love to have cities that were filled with gardens in which we garden not just flowers, but many, many species that fly around us and live among us. So I've gone on too long, but I love this sentiment that, you know, that the entirety of the earth that we've sampled has life, with very brief moments of lifelessness. You know, if you're having an active surgery, the exact place where the surgery is happening can be treated with bleach so that for just those moments it doesn't have life. But boy, the second that last stitch goes in, you're covered again.
You just touch upon something which, since we have this free dialogue, I'm jumping in. The surgery. This is probably one of the most climatic points when the formation of defensive bacteria, where the crisis of the human body depends so much on immediate defense mechanism. And your example with the surgery, in my estimation, one of the most incredibly revealing facts and phenomena of nature, because as soon as knife goes in, there is immediate, almost like a waking up the whole world of this bacteria which comes to rescue.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I mean, I think that we in the context of surgery, bacteria can play both a good and a bad role. You know, the individual bad species can, if they get inside our skin, can wreak havoc. But at the same time, we have all these good species that help to defend us. I would like people to imagine a flu virus lands on your body. The first thing it encounters is not your immune system, it's your bacteria. And that's what probably kills the flu virus in most cases. And so it's our invisible cloak that saves us in so many of these situations.
Yes, in my case, indeed, I choose to talk about the power of bacteria. You're absolutely right. It can be, especially in a frail body, that can be disbalanced, and bad bacteria can be very threatening. But I choose to make a point with a good bacteria, and if we will add some analysis of blood content and all these white cells immediate coming to the plate. So we will go into more profound analysis of it. I like to make a link to somewhat, I would call it a secret, which is not uncovered. Exactly what you're doing and all this intimacy which you uncovering with this small world, which has such a giant role, probably has its own medical surprises. We all know that, for example, snake poison can be extremely useful, but I only can imagine what kind of medical benefits can be from some of those species. I think some of it, I don't remember exactly where, but I came across a few times in your writing about that. Maybe you can comment on that.
Yeah, I mean, so one interesting example would be that if anybody in your audience has smelly feet, that one of the bacteria species that produces that smell, the one of the stinkiest, is called Bacillus subtilis. It's actually related to the bacteria that's in some stinky Japanese foods, by coincidence, no coincidence. I think that part of what's going on with that bacteria on your feet is that that your feet are actively sweating more than they need to, and your sweat actually has lots of amino acids in it, which are at least partially for those bacteria. I suspect that as we study those bacteria more, one of the things we will figure out that they are doing is they're preventing us from developing fungal foot infections. And we know from the lab that that same bacteria produces lots of antifungal compounds. And so in the lab, it can kill the same fungus that produces athlete's foot. And so I think that's actually a pretty good example, in as much as we know little pieces of the story. We don't have the whole story worked out. But it seems like one of these cases where we're favoring our body favors a specific lineage of bacteria. But another example, you mentioned the connection between species earlier, or the connection between people. So when one of the places we're learning the most about our bacteria is in the context of birth. And so for a long time, it was assumed that newborn babies just sort of picked up bacteria from the environment around them. It now appears that they actually get many of their bacteria directly from their mothers. And that depends on the kind of birth. And so vaginal births, those babies actually get a fairly big dose of gut bacteria from their mother during birth. They even get some bacteria that move through, it looks like, the placenta into the baby. C-section babies have very different bacteria, and one of the biggest differences anyone has found between people in terms of their bacteria is a function of whether they're born C-section or vaginally. And so we have this connection to the mother's good bacteria. But one of the amazing things that's just been figured out in the last couple of years is that the mother actually provides more bacteria than just those during birth. That breast milk actually has bacteria that are moved up through the mother's body and into the milk. So the milk itself, not the surface of the breast, has bacteria in it that are being fed to the baby. And that these are specific beneficial lineages of bacteria. And so, I mean, I think one of the really amazing things here is that our bodies know a lot about how to favor some of these species. And it's our conscious minds and science that are struggling to catch up with some of this knowledge.
I cannot hide my excitement because I just was about to make a comment about the babies and saying that we think that the new baby was born, but indeed the whole camp of bacteria was born with this baby. And when you started to talk about the babies, I almost jumped because that was my thought, you know, and actually my question. And you just beautifully answered it. Makes such sense. And I always had these strong reservations about C-sections because it became almost like a common practice. And I think what you just described is a true proof that every natural process has its own profound wisdom benefits. And in old times, the breastfeeding mother would not be allowed to drink alcohol, would not be allowed to take medicine, would not be allowed to do many things because that milk would be a holy connection between her and newborn baby. And you just gave us such a fantastic picture and clarification. We have only a few minutes left, unfortunately. I mean, this 55 minutes became a little longer with a wonderful exhibition of your panoramic view of nature. You gave us such a totally new perception and a reality. So next time I will walk around, I will see who is my true companion is. And I truly was mesmerized when I read a few things in your second book. We just didn't have a time, and perhaps if your schedule can permit, maybe we can have another program and continuation, because I believe that along with the new birth of new species, there will be a new birth of so many questions and ideas among listeners. And I just wanted to thank you so much to give us this opening at a time when you really need to be aware. One needs to be aware that this highly stressful world we're living in, where we are not very well aware and respectful to the balance between what is nature offers and certain sterile, superficial mechanisms we're using. And I think what you're doing is such a tissue of the issue, such a heart of our life, that I personally wanted to thank you for having this gift, perseverance, curiosity, and generosity to share it with all of us.
Well, thank you so much, Lena. It's been a real pleasure, and hopefully we can meet in person someday and shake hands and share microbes. And I thank your listeners as well. It's been a great joy.
And I'm sure your microbes are very special.
And yours as well. Thank you so much.
Thank you. All the best. And I will make my final thoughts with our musical accompaniment. And I wanted to say that we're all thankful to BBS, who again helped us to produce this this extremely wonderful and memorable program. We are looking forward to our next program in a couple of weeks. And for now, enjoy finally summer. Be friendly with your neighbor species and appreciate Mother Nature. We need it, and they need us in our very natural way. That was Lena Live, and I'm your Lena Miermond. Until next time, with a lot of sunshine. Thank you.